everybody, thanks so much. We really have an exciting podcast, and this is part one of part two. And if you're listening to Fire Breathing Rob for the first time, whether it's the radio, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, wherever it may be, please subscribe, like, share this. If you're listening to on the radio on one of the 20 stations, definitely tell your friends and your family about this. We do interview people that have amazing stories about all different types of topics. So we have, like I said, a special guest on today. This is Mickey Royal. He's done so many things in his life that we can learn from, and that's why we're going to have him on at least another time, maybe even more. Depends how the second one goes, because he's got so much value to bring to the podcast and the radio show in general. So just a little bit about Mickey. He's a good, a bad guy turned good, I guess we should say. That's what it says on his website. Former gangster, drug dealer, pimp, mob enforcer, pornographer, and a best-selling author. And he's got quite a few books out. So I'm just going to read this off the screen. Obviously, the most popular books is The Pimp Game Instructional Guide and also The Pimp Game Mind Manipulation. He also has Pimping Ain't Easy, But Someone's Got to Do It, I'm Leaving You for a White Woman, and Along for the Ride. Again, if you want to find more about Mickey, it's mickeyroyal.com. Mickey, that was a mouthful for me to say of all the things you've done and all the work you've put out, but I appreciate having you on, and I was so excited to hear about your story at the conference, and I'm looking forward to hearing more stories as we keep doing these interviews with you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much. You know, the introduction is true, but I'm sure it's made my parents proud.
All right, Mickey.
But it is what it is, you know.
Well, you know what? Even if something's bad, I think you always can learn something and help people out. And I'm sure that you're helping people throughout this podcast. You'll be helping our viewers learn more about the stuff you did. So, you know, they can learn those lessons. And I'm sure you've helped quite a few people in the lessons that you've went through your life. So I'm sure a lot of people are appreciative of that. But I want to get into this. Let's first start off, you know, growing up. So you grew up, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Mickey, you had parents that were teachers, is that correct?
Yes, both my parents have master's degrees, retired teachers.
Right, so with that said, growing up in that type of environment and, you know, that type of educational background with your parents, it's, you know, I would think that they would really put the pressure on you to be successful in education. They probably did, of course, knowing that they were extremely successful throughout their lives in education. But can you talk about that environment growing up in that and how it led toward drug dealing, the pimp game, and sex lifestyle in general?
Well, I have to go back all the way to, like, because what the turning point was, I would say about 11 and a half, 12. My parents had gotten a divorce. Okay. So the economic standpoint or our economics changed tremendously. So we went from the top of the hill to the bottom of the hill. Then my mother got really sick with cancer. So it was just me and my older brother kind of in control. You know, we shouldn't have, but we took advantage of the situation that where she wasn't that mobile and she couldn't really do much and she couldn't really work. And my father had gotten remarried and left the state and pretty much continue his life. I mean, it was phone calls and a few checks here, but he had a new wife, he had new children. And it was just my brother and I, and we went outside. And I don't think I came back in until I was 41. So that's when it started, you know, 12 and a half to 13. And it was just full blown after that.
So,
because I had no supervision, no parameters.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mickey. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that was it. It was just, it was no more. It went from a strict household to basically no household at all because she was sick. We had much less money and my brother was already kind of 1 foot out there anyway. And I just followed him along and that was that, you know?
So we hear a lot about this, I guess, with young kids in general that, you know, at that age, you know, obviously you're learning new things about yourself. You're trying new things, whether it could be sex, drugs. You know, this is all different backgrounds that are doing this at that type of age in the teenage years. So Did someone come up to you and approach you about, drugs and gangs and stuff like that? Or was that something like you said, you followed your brother into that? Did he start that? How did all that occur?
Well, I hate to sound cliche, but the year was 1985. You just saw Scarface. You just saw, I mean, you're dealing with Miami Vice. I'm around 12, 12 and a half, 13, and it's all glamorous. And I don't want to sound cliche, but they were all involved in one way or another. Everyone you went around, this is Los Angeles at the time, and this is like where the movie Colors was set. So if you weren't involved, the next door neighbor's son was, the other guy's son was, his maybe this guy wasn't. But his two little brothers and maybe his uncle from so and so. It is so enriched in Los Angeles history and in Los Angeles culture that you are involved whether you want to or not. Now, how involved you are depends on you. So it's never really an approach in like a job application. Hey, would you like to? It's just that the more you associate, and these are the kids you play basketball with, these are the kids you used to throw footballs with. It's a little different now. And then when crack cocaine came in around 85, 86, you see people who have things who didn't have things a month ago, and they have money, and they keep in mind how young we are. So we're not talking about cars yet. We're talking about new bikes, but you have grown-ups dealing with them as a grown-up. And it's just the allure is too strong. I mean, even knowing what I know right now, when I got into the pimp game and seedy into the underworld, knowing what I know now, I still wouldn't have been strong enough to resist it.
The government, whether it's Democrat or Republican, really doesn't care about the people in the middle class, doesn't care about the people that are on the streets that are homeless. I look think of Skid Row. You're talking about Los Angeles, that it's insane what goes on down there. I don't know if you've ever been there, but
Oh
if
God, yeah, I'm from there. It's
okay.
100,000 of them down there at any time. We're talking about 8 blocks, 100,000 people. But from what I understand now, when it comes to Los Angeles, they're everywhere. I mean, Crenshaw Boulevard has tents up at night. You don't see them in the daytime as much. You'll see tents, but you'll see long line of vans, motor homes, and maybe old SUVs with dark plastic in the window. Well, that's because they live in there. And you'll see a lot of tents, these small tents. As far as the eye can see, Hollywood, everything, it's really ridiculous. When I got out of prison 2017, when I went in, they didn't have this phenomenon. It was primarily Skid Row, and you had some shelters. When I got out, it's everywhere, any street. These little campers they buy, because I guess they save their money and buy like $1,500 campers that are like 1984, but they don't move. They just stay parked because you can't crank that thing. It looks like Fred Sanford's old truck, but they live in there. And I'm for real. It's oh, you can tell how old it is, and you tell it doesn't move. They move it just enough for street sweeping, so they won't get a ticket and come back. But they live there, and you have homeless people, some in LA that I knew of or know of that have jobs and they go to work every day, but they come back to that camper or that tent. And it's just ridiculous now, especially if you roll through at night. Porta potty set up on the streets.
You feel like a lot of these people that you personally knew, the people that you grew up with, and you kind of talked about this, saying that you saw they were getting great stuff and with the crack cocaine epidemic back in the 80s. Do you feel like if these people had good paying jobs, good health care, a good home to come back to, even if they weren't multimillionaires, if they were making pretty decent money, to have that middle class lifestyle with health care and a house, do you feel like they would a turn to that? Do you feel like you would have turned to that kind of lifestyle if that was going on?
Yes and no. It's a different mentality on the east side as it is on the west side. A lot of people on the east side who were in those neighborhoods were more violent because gangs were already around at the time. And those people on the east side who went after drugs is because their lives were so miserable. And the ones who sold drugs is because they wanted to make money and live a better life. Now, on the west side, it's a little better. I'm from the West Side. A lot of us, and I'm just being honest because it doesn't fit the Hollywood narrative, it was exciting. A lot of people on the West Side got involved in that because their lives were boring. It was exciting. You had the music. We were coming out of the breakdance era. I told one person in an interview, I said, kind of breakdancing did it, because I was so into just, I couldn't really do it physically, but I loved watching it. So whenever they had the little circle, but what it did was at 12, it got me out of the house. It got me around grownups. It got me looking at something that was just so energetic and excitement. And I just never went back in the house. I was like 40, 41 years old. So, and it just went from this to this to this to this. But a lot of it with me was the allure and the excitement and the fact that I was playing grown-up amongst grown-ups, only being in the seventh grade. And you couldn't tell me that anything else was better than that.
So you think it's more of the people that were on the east side that would have kind of fit the, you know, the objective that I stated, that, you know, if they had better housing, better jobs, health care, and they were living that, you know, decent life, middle-class life, they wouldn't have kind of went into that game. Whereas you on the west side, they would have went into that game, most people, regardless.
Yeah, if they had wanted to.
Yeah.
Because it's like, that's exactly what it was. The narrative you have, and most Hollywood has, that is true on the east side. But you remember Nipsey Hussle just getting killed. Mm. That's a heavy gang neighborhood, the Rolling 60s. They have a faction called Rich Rolling 60s. Now, where Nipsey Hussle got killed, he's not even, and I notice how close this is, he's not even 400 feet away from Million Dollar Homes. That's Windsor Hills, that's Ladera Heights. Gang activity in Los Angeles is not economically related. You can get shot by, you can get caught in the drive-by by somebody driving a Mercedes. Mm. I mean, it has nothing to do with economics. That's not a poor neighborhood where he got killed. Yeah. If you cross that street, if you go back this way, because that's all deep west side, go back this way, the houses are $500,000, which is nothing to shake a stick at. You might find a 354. If you cross the street to the left and go 300 or 400 feet, that's like half a block, those houses are $800,000 to $1.2 million. And that's a heavy gang area right there. I used to tell people on the west side of LA, there are no poor communities. There are violent communities. I said, you want to see a poor community, go to Arkansas, Mississippi. But I said, Los Angeles, close to the beach, they're not poor, but the mentality of it, you know, like I said, those are million-dollar homes where he is. That's Windsor Hills, that's Ladera Heights, to the point where they're called Rich Rolling 60s. You'll still get killed over there.
Why do you feel like, you know, I've watched videos on YouTube of how bad LA is right now still. You know, you talked about the homeless problem, but I'm talking about the violence, the gang issues, and it's horrendous over there. With all this money that the police is getting, do you feel like it's just because they're involved in all this? They're pushing the drugs on the street. They're letting these guys do whatever they want. They're involved in all this. They're making money off this. So is that why that's going on, along with the sex trafficking, which is huge still? Are they letting all this stuff go?
To get in detail about, I mean, I've seen things growing up.
Yeah.
But I don't really see them too much anymore.
Okay.
As far as the police, I knew personal police that were involved.
Yeah.
But on a whole, I think the problem is so overwhelming. So you got to look at the streets as a microcosm of the world. Mm. So you have to look at it like you have Iran, you have Iraq, you have Northrop, McDonnell Douglas, places like that who manufacture weapons. They manufacture weapons and they sell them to both sides. Now, if you got an outside contract with somebody like Blackwater or whatever, is there really an incentive with billion-dollar contracts to stop the war? Right. There's no money made if the war stops. You know, it's not so much you're encouraging violence. It's just that if you're a private industry or entity or a or an entrepreneurial type industry, would it, if you and I own a McDonald's together, mm-hmm. how smart, I mean, would you be a little ticked at me if I was out front giving people health tips on how they should go vegan? I mean, you get a little pissed like, hey, I know they should go vegan. You know they should go vegan, but we're trying to do something here. Now, are you shoving burgers literally down people's throats? No. Are you pouring an extra amount of grease into stuff? No. You're providing a product that the people seem to want.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But you and I know that we should be promoting a, what they call it, plant-based lifestyle. But if we do, we're out of business. Yeah. So there's no incentive to promote a plant-based lifestyle.
Are you saying that basically you personally think that the government is letting a lot of this go, especially the police? They don't want, you know, this stuff to go away because this is more police violence. This is more that they can arrest people. It's good for their pockets. Is that kind of what you're saying with that, or no?
Well, in California, I can speak specifically on that on a microcosmic level as opposed to the entire country.
Sure.
They have a saying in California, you come on probation, you come on vacation and leave on probation. The prison industrial complex in California is so strong. I heard a correctional officer tell me my last day that this is California. Either you're in the system or you work for it. That's it. Either you're an inmate or a CO. He said, that's California. Either you're in the system. When I say in the system, I mean from doing life or on death row all the way down to getting a traffic ticket. You will see us. You will deposit some money because that is how we make money. We don't care if it's a traffic ticket. We don't care if the parking meter's off and you owe us $20. That's a part of the system. He said, either you're paying us or getting paid by us. But somewhere or another, California is more so run like a communist country. I wouldn't say that far, but no, it's a little past socialist. I would have to say that, yeah.
I do want to jump back into what's going on right now. So a lot of people do have this perspective of, you know, not knowing what prostitution is to sex trafficking. They don't know that difference. Can you explain it to the viewers, the difference between those two things?
Well, a pimp is not a sex, it's not a human trafficker.
Right.
Those are two different things. I've known hardcore human traffickers, and most of which are not from this country. Mm. You know, Latinos, they were below the border, South America, as well as Mexico. Egyptians, Chinese, and they're literally trafficking. Russians I dealt with in my 20s. That's not a pimp. You know, a pimp thing is more so manipulation and seduction. A trafficker, he might grab a woman from Walmart right out of the parking lot, four guys just snatch her into a van. A pimp would never do that.
Right.
You know, and That's one of the biggest differences. The force, the held hostage, and all of those are traffickers. A pimp, you can try to rescue a prostitute from a pimp, and she'll probably fight you and jump in front of a bullet for him. That's because he's in her head, and they have some kind of relationship. You know, he's basically a manager of some sorts. I mean, if Don King is taking care of me and I'm his fighter, I'm not going to let you beat him up. I'm going to jump in front of him. Why? Because I was fighting for $500,000 yesterday. My next fight is $10 million, and that's because that man made it possible. Now, the fact that I'm going to give him three of that and keep seven for myself, I still think that's better than the $500,000 that I had last week. You know, so, and the reason is the confusion comes in because they pass laws against human traffickers, but they enforce the laws against people who are in the pimp gang. Those are not the same. So the laws that they pass against human traffickers don't affect human traffickers. That's like passing a law against a bank robber. It doesn't affect the bank robber. He's robbing a bank. You know, or sometimes you can pass laws against, pass gun laws. Gun laws only affect citizens who don't want burglars to break into their house. Let me tell you something. When people go do gangster stuff or street stuff, they don't go to Guns and Ammo and Target and Walmart to get their guns. See, they don't do a background check. That background check only slows you down from being able to defend yourself. No guy goes, you know, that bank we're going to rob tomorrow morning? We can't, man. I got this 7-day waiting period, and we'll do it in 7 days. No, they already have their guns. You're just stopping the other guy from protecting himself. You're not taking guns out of criminals' hands because you didn't put them there. You put them in civilians' hands. Yeah. You know, so those laws don't affect criminals.
Yeah.
You think a criminal who his whole identity is to break a law, is going to uphold a law that's going to slow him down from breaking the law, which is what he is. Criminals laugh at that. That doesn't affect them. It just affects regular people.
Now I hear you. Mickey Royal, again, for people that aren't listening, go to mickeyroyal.com. Plenty of good books. We're going to jump more into the book right now. So we talk about pimp game and that. What makes a good pimp, Mickey?
He has to be smart. Mm-hmm. He has to understand body language. He has to understand, or she has to understand human emotions and how to manipulate them. You're not controlling. You're manipulating. It's almost like the martial arts style Aikido. I'm using your weight and your force against you. The faster you come at me, the faster you fall. I didn't grab you. I just guided you into a wall. That's all. So you have to really understand psychological control, manipulation, not control, but psychological control of oneself and one's desires and their innate desires and how to manipulate them for your benefit. So it's a thinking game. You have different types of pimp, but it's all a psychological game, right down to a gorilla pimp. It's still a psychological game. They understand when you're in a pimp game, you've studied things like Stockholm syndrome. You've studied things like the frog technique. You have the lobster technique. You have different techniques. The elephant technique. You actually study these things. They're your subjects. And you notice things. Every little thing. It's almost like you're playing chess with people. So you have to really be aware of everything to his right down to his detail. When that will make a good pimp. Understanding all the rules and regulations that go into it and every last minute detail, because you're dealing with the human mind. That's the playing field in which you are playing. That's your basketball court.
So what type of woman would you be looking for, though? Because, you know, every guy thinks of woman differently. You know, some might want a black woman, white woman, skinny, fat, maybe middle of the road as far as weight goes. So how do you find that woman, obviously, that's going to, you know, be good on the street?
Well, towards the end, it depends what I'm looking for. No different than a coach. I need to go find a basketball player. I don't need a basketball player. I need a center.
Yeah.
Because I'm building a certain team. So I'm looking for people 7 feet, 6'10" at the smallest. So if you show me Michael Jordan, he's a good basketball player. He's not what I'm looking for. He's good, but he's not what I'm looking for. See, I already have point guards. I have a great one. I need a center. So what I'm looking for at that particular time depends on what I am casting for. And now if I'm looking for a woman to walk the street, that's a certain type of woman. If I'm looking for a woman to work the clubs, that's a certain type of woman. If I'm looking for a stripper, not all prostitutes can dance. Right. And not all strippers are prostitutes. If I'm looking for a woman to do porn, that's a different type of woman. If I'm looking for, when I had my call girls, and I need people with a certain mentality that can work the Hollywood crowd and to work certain parties. Well, I can't take a woman off the street to do that. She doesn't have the charisma to accomplish that for me. So it depends on what position I'm feeling. If I'm trying to build a stable, then I need someone with no leadership ability that's more docile because I can start with her. But if I'm trying to build a certain type of family, and I need someone to go out and do this and that and the other, then I need a seasoned veteran who knows how to recruit and knows almost as much as I do. So it depends what I need her for, what I'm trying to build. I don't need five alpha females in one house.
Right. So you had multiple, you worked multiple places, like, you know, you talked about Hollywood parties, stripping on the street. So you worked in all those different venues, or was it like one part of your life you worked in one area, another part you worked in another area, or most in one part of your life you worked mostly in a certain area? So where did you mostly work? Go ahead.
I've done all of it.
Right.
You know, but sometimes they went on at the same time. See, it wasn't, okay. It's a natural progression or regression, depends on how you look at it. I say ascend or descend, depending on which side you're standing on. But I say ascend. But if you're on the street, it's not like, okay, he was this, and then he moved to this, and then he moved to this. No, it kind of blends. So if you're doing it 10 years and you have what they call high-class call girl rings, you got people, because pornography really kicked into another gear. So now I have women on box covers, now people flying in from other countries just to be with these women, you know, because they're stars now. That doesn't mean I don't have women still on the street. That doesn't mean I don't have women still in calling at what I call stores, but they were basically homemade bordellos. You know, it just depends on who can work what. Everyone doesn't have the same talents.
But, you know, you can only be at one place at one time. So if you have, you know, girls on the street, if you have the call girls with meeting with these expensive guys, if we want to call them sugar daddies or whatever it may be, you know, how do you have other people working with you? Because obviously, like I said, you can't be in, you know, 10 places at one time. If a girl needs help, if she runs into a tough situation or some guy's beating the crap out of her, doesn't want to pay, you know, so how do you deal with all those situations going on at one time?
Well, it depends on your growth. If you have two or three, it's not hard. It depends on where you have them. That's what took me off the street. That was one of the reasons I left the street and started building houses. I made more money inside, in call. It's like if you're going to buy, let's say you're buying a television. If I'm selling you a television off the street in a brand new box and you know it's brand new, you saw me steal it. You know it's brand new. It's a $300 TV. You might give me 80 bucks for it because you bought it off the street. But that same television, you go to, let's say, Blockbuster or something, you'll pay $300 for that. Because anything bought off the street, I learned, is not the same price as if it's bought in a store. So I opened Human Stores. And I found that they were in certain locations and houses were easier to rent because you're doing a private person than an actual apartment complex. I did have a few apartment complexes, but they had to be, you had to be really careful because you got a lot of traffic coming through. You don't want to, you're being discreet. And people who come over there, you're picking places off the freeway. And they're really, these are old men, usually Caucasian, coming from Orange County, usually married, usually with money. They want to zip in, zip out. So you have to pick places that are off the freeway a lot of time. They don't want to go driving up and down through here because it seems like a setup. They want to get off, no pun intended, and get back home. So it was easier to be in that type of situation when you got a four-bedroom house, and I always put one more in as opposed to a bedroom. So it's five women in a four-bedroom house. You have a house here, you have there. So if you got like 15, 20 people, 20 women under you, you're going to need help. You know, you're going to have a lot of, you're going to have to break it down into a military / mafia type structure, depending on what type of life you come from. But it's pyramidal because you're going to have old women, what they call, I don't like to use the term because I really don't use the B word when I speak, but bottom, B-I-T-C-H, but I like to say bottom woman. But you would have a woman there, she's about in her mid-40s, and you don't have to check on her all the time. You know, you come through maybe once every 2 days because you can't be in all these places at one time. And you got women going to all-star games and you got conventions over here downtown going on. So you might have to send some of your goons over there and they would be more in a chauffeur type bodyguard situation. They wouldn't walk in with her, but they would be outside and like, if you need me, call me. I come in there, boom, bam, brother, because he can't come in there with her. At certain conventions, he's not... You know what I mean? You're on the list. She's on the list. You're not. My women could go places that I couldn't go. I wasn't invited to those places, but they were.
So, Mickey, when you went and got these women, how did you approach them if you wanted them? If you thought that woman was good for, whether it was house parties as far as maybe a Hollywood party or even if it was for some rich white guy that was coming down to do a one-time deal. Were they mostly college girls? Did you mostly recruit them? Or how did you recruit the woman in general? Like, because you can't just go up to some woman and say, hey, you know, I got a deal for you. It's not like The Godfather or something.
Well, I was telling people, I said, prostitution in any form, sex work in any form is a skill. Yeah. You can't just find a big guy and be like, you know what? You'd make a good heavyweight champion. He works at Walmart. He'd get in there and get his brains beat in about 30 seconds because because he's big doesn't mean he knows how to fight. No more than just because a guy is tall does not mean he knows how to play basketball. I'm going to put you against Michael Jordan. I'm not a basketball player. I'm a chemist. Why are you putting, well, you're 6'6". I know you play ball. No, I don't. So you can't, I was telling that in another interview when they say bus stations and train stations. I say, yeah, those are usually serial killer bait or human trafficking bait. You know, but pimps, that's a skill. Yeah. So if you're looking for a pro basketball player, I'm building a team, where am I going to look? I'm going to look for the college ranks because they're already trained. They're already here. And I'm going to tell you something else. I may look at the high school ranks or Rutgers Park or Venice Beach because you may have one or two there with the talent of a pro, but not really looking over there hard. You go straight to the NCAA. So I said, they choose you. They know who you are when you walk in. So you go to strip clubs. You go to after hours. She hasn't made it yet to in call. She hasn't made it yet to pornography. She hasn't made it yet and knows how to finesse a sugar daddy. But she's dancing at bachelor parties on the weekends.
Sorry. What do you call that? When the missing persons.
Amber alerts.
Amber alert. And I thought I shut it off, but apparently I didn't. So
go ahead. They come in when the phone is off even. Yeah. I think they do still pop on.
Oh, God, disaster. But anyway, go ahead.
But no, you look for the college ranks.
Right.
And you've been scouting them. And you send your scouters there. It's like, I remember one time at my height, I had a woman dancing at every strip club. And people would think, oh, he got his women at the, if I wanted my women to make money at the club, I would have several of them there. I have my alpha females there. I don't have them there to make money. I have them there to bring those other three with them. Right. That's why they're there. Because she's 35. She looks 25. She's 35. She's smarter than the other girls. They're actually 19, but have fake IDs to say they're 21 or 22. And a lot of them, the stereotype is that these women have daddy issues. They really don't. They have mommy issues. Mm-hmm. See, when I approach them, if I approach them, because usually they approach you, the woman chooses the pimp. It's usually not the other way around. But sometimes if I approach, their defenses go up, because you got to understand, in a woman in a sex trade's life, no matter how small or how large, every man in her life wants something from her. Either you're trying to take her money, her body, or her time. So her defense mechanisms are up. So I don't come in as the lion. She can see me coming a mile away. She can't see that beautiful 42-year-old snake sneaking up and slithering around her legs. See, that's her mommy. That's her friend. Girl, let me teach you something. And she's grooming her the entire time. By the time she meets me, she's already ready, but she doesn't know that the 42-year-old and me at the time, let's say 26 back then, that was over 20 years ago, she doesn't know that this has been planned over the course of time. This is all premeditated.
Mickey, have you ever got a girl that, I guess you said the woman would be training the girl before they got to you, but have you ever got a girl, maybe when they got to you, that was a little shaky, still nervous, or were they already prepared and, you know, snap of the fingers, ready to go?
Both. I mean, and I had the benefit of being in Los Angeles. You have right. The Valley, Porn Valley, that's Chatsworth. And you had Hollywood.
Yeah, and everybody so wants to be an actress. And they, mm-hmm. you know, if they can't do that, they still need to make money. If they're good looking, they're going to try to go to, you know, your trade.
And one of the best places I had was Cal State Northridge. Mm. It was, it's in the Valley. And anyone in the Valley knows that the entire city of Chatsworth at the time is being supported by the porn industry. So they're not looked down on. So when you up there and they know that you're in the porn industry, you could literally just put up not even a flyer, but a white piece of paper that you're auditioning. And you have, you know, you cut the numbers like that. And I used to advertise in the LA Weekly, LA Express in the back that I was looking for women to do pornography auditions and how much you pay, whatever. The phones would, I only needed 5 per week. I would get 20 calls a day, 20, 25, wow. all through the night, 2 o'clock in the morning. I didn't have enough work for all of them. So some, and I would give them actually a questionnaire sheet because porn is legal, so I can do this. And they would fill out the sheet and it would say other jobs considered sometimes. This is once I started mature. This is like 8 years into the life. I was still in my 20s, but I was getting there. And they would say, yeah, I'll consider this. And sometimes it's like every girl that works the street does not want to dance. Every girl that dances or does in-call does not want to do porn. Because a lot of them will tell you, you know, I'm going to be somebody's wife one day. I'm going to have children one day, and I don't want them to see me on film. But I do God knows whatever 24 hours a day, 7 days a week until I quit. I'm like, okay. Some women will tell you, I just want to do movies. Okay. Whatever your comfort zone is, I don't care how you get it. You can pan for gold. You can dig it. I'm Levi Strauss. I'm going to be the mining director. It goes in this bucket. So whatever is conducive to how you want to do things. And that was a better approach to when I was younger and what I learned from other pimps. Their hand was more, no, you're going to do it this way. That's because they didn't have any expansion, any room for growth. They started on the street. 40 years later, they're still on the street. I took other connections and went to doing other things in other ways to the point where I could set up an entire network, which led to pornography. I met some big wheels in pornography. So I had the power to take a girl from the street who was a nobody and make her a somebody in a neighborhood for the nobodies and pull her out of the neighborhood. Because I explained one time, I said, how much would you pay to have sex with a Puerto Rican girl? And God said, 300. I said, okay, a pretty Puerto Rican girl. He said, 300. I said, how much would you pay to have sex with Cardi B? And he was like, man, I give like 20 grand. I said, okay, I'm the guy whose job is to make that pretty Puerto Rican girl Cardi B. Now, I don't own a rap company. But see, if I put her on this box cover, and I put her with the top male porn stars, and I put a publicist behind her name, now her $300 just went up to $5,000. Shouldn't I get a cut of that? I performed such a magic trick.
But isn't, yeah, no, I agree with you, Mickey. But isn't the porn industry getting smoked right now with Pornhub and X Hamster and all these other porn sites that, you know, give out these free porn videos that people don't, you know, I'm sure some people still go and buy porn videos at the adult stores and stuff like that. I know you're out of the game, but do you know anything about that? And I feel like that would be crushing the industry in general because it's free.
Well, I used to own an adult film store in Inglewood, California,
Okay.
and I saw almost overnight, it was DVDs, few VHS, but VHS was pretty much gone then. It was DVDs, sex toys, and clothing. And I saw us go from a packed house to maybe two customers a day in almost a week. It was an overnight thing. And my distributor said, no one in their right mind is going to pay for something they can get for free. It's just not going to happen. And we tried and we tried and we unionized, and you had the Vivid people and the Larry Flints and trying, because the thing was, people get tap water for free, but they also buy Arrowhead. So maybe we could, it didn't work. The there is no porn industry, if you want to be honest. It died. It didn't die. No, I'm sorry. It didn't die. The internet murdered it. It murdered it. I went back when I got out of prison. I had a little money, maybe owed to me, whatever. I figured I can pick up maybe 8, 10 grand from my old place, you know, because you know how you leave, you have money on the street, as they say. I went back to an old distributor. It's a charter school now. Little
Wow.
kids were in the front where the big parking lot is, and they had put some swings there. I said, yeah, it's over. It's all over. And I just went back to my car. I said, it's over. These companies don't exist anymore. These places, it was a charter school. And I just stood there looking at the kids, and I was like, and I'm still thinking, like, okay, he's gonna come downstairs any minute now. Like, I don't see these kids playing, and it has a name on it. It's in Chatsworth. And I said, it's all over. It's gone, you know, and I just left.
So how are these porn stars making money now? Because they're still porn stars. I mean, they still have those big conventions in Las Vegas, and I'm sure in California too. So how are they making money off the internet now? Are they doing like OnlyFans, or you know, I mean, that's the only way I can think. You know, I'm sure people particularly like a woman or like a man, and they may, you know, buy this stuff, but I'm sure it's not like you said, it's not like it used to be.
No, the product market is dead, but you gotta understand this is a skill and they adjust. So the answer to your question is yes. And if people have to understand there's a lot of diversified in this business, just like any other business. So what is she doing? Is she on OnlyFans? Yes. Well, what about sugarbabies.com? Oh, she has a page there too. Well, she's still seeing in-call from, yes, from Sugar Babies, long-term clients, but she's doing short-term clients because she has a website and you can come physically be with her. It's just that the price is higher. So she's doing OnlyFans, she's doing Sugar Babies, she's doing in-call. Oh, and she's a featured dancer 2, 3 nights a week. So if you add all of that up, yes, she's still making a living and probably a very good one. Now, is it the good old days where you can do one movie a month and make thousands of dollars, where you can just live off that and the rest of the month you're just pretty much doing nothing? No, those days are gone. But because porn hubs, and it's just like with the music business, there was a time where a person might make $5 per album that they sold, or a unit of that, you know, net. They might net that. Now they have to do something like 100,000 streams to get like $1,000 or something like that. So in the old days, if you sold 100,000 copies, that's a $500,000 wholesale, because the album is usually $12. But that's how much you would grow, the company would make. And you might make that 4% royalty or whatever. But now I look at, sometimes I see some sites, it's like once you get 1 million streams, you get $2,000. I'm like, what? I mean, can you imagine that? Michael Jackson sells 1 million copies and he gets 2 grand. So that's what they're going through now because of the streaming thing. They don't make nearly as much money, so they have to diversify. They have to do it all to make what they used to make, you know, to keep up with that same flow of economy, you know.
Obviously, we know that the FBI has used a lot of your techniques, and I guess they've read your books. When did you find out about that? Did they come to you? Did you go to them? How did all that stuff work?
Well, early on, because I've worked with them before, I don't know if I should talk about this, but there was, when I was a full-blooded criminal, I used to lift weights at the YMCA, and I met an agent there. And I didn't feel he was undercover because he revealed himself to me. I'm like, if you're undercover, remember how Maxwell Smart used to say, I'm secret agent Maxwell Smart. I'm like, you know, if you tell everybody, it's not much of a secret. That's how you meet people at the store. Hi, I'm secret agent. And so he just told me, we're in the steam room and we used to actually work out together. And he came to me with a problem about his niece had gotten kidnapped or trafficked, whatever, but she didn't want to come home. And he said he couldn't lose his job. And I'm like, why are you telling me this? And he was like, well, do you think you can like put the word out on the street and maybe help bring her home? I said, no, I can go get her. And he was like, I said, I usually charge for something like this. This is heavy work. I said, but I'll do it for your friendship. I said, I like you. And we've been lifting weights together. He said, if something happens, I can't help you. I can't lose my job. I said, well, I have the kind of job I can't lose. And if I get arrested, I actually move up in ranks. So I said, I'll do this for you. I'll go physically get it. I said, you know where she is? I said, yeah. I said, okay. Some underworld friends of mine watched it for a couple of days and we got her. So he was always a good contact, you know, as far as that, because I just did that as a favor because I liked him as a person. And I can tell he was really scared. And I was thinking on my way to do it with some friends that this is a setup. Boy, did I get set up. Oh, God. Please don't let this be like when I run in, freeze out. Oh God, well, how could I be so stupid? But it was honestly a man who didn't know what to do. He said, I have all this power and connections. And I have no power here. And I know exactly where she is and I can't afford to risk my job. And they're not giving me authorization to do anything. He said, do you think you can talk to him? I said, they're not going to listen to me. They're going to have to feel me. We're going to have to physically go in there and extract them. And he said, I can't help you and I can't vouch for you. It was just like Mission Impossible. If you get caught, I never met you, but I really appreciate this. And I said, okay, maybe down the road you can do something for me that I'll appreciate, which he did, you know. But yeah, he let me know because that's how he knew who I was. It was another woman. I think her name is Kimberly, M-E-H-L. She writes books about human trafficking and stuff like that. And I know she orders a lot of books from me. And I know they use them for FBI classes and stuff. And she said, you know, the FBI has been using your book as kind of a textbook. I said, really? Because I haven't heard anything. She said, well, I know at least 11, for the past 11 years. I'm like, really? So I heard it from two sources, her, because she works directly with them. And I also heard it from a guy who heard it from a Las Vegas Police Department that they were also using it because it's the only how-to of its kind. And if you can systematically take apart something psychologically and systematically take apart something, then you can read it backwards and systematically, psychologically put something back together. So they use it because it gets into, it's not stories as far as the pimp game is concerned. It is the workings of the mind and the techniques and the mind controlling techniques we use. Like, I remember one guy, am I talking too much?
I was just going to say, where are the royalties that they should be getting back?
Now, they do buy the books from me. I appreciate that because they use a middleman. Okay, I appreciate that, but yeah, I mean, if you're sitting there teaching it, I think the person who wrote it could teach it a little better than the person who's interpreting it, you know. But it is what it is, you know. I've had a few cases with them that I had to avoid, you know, that they lost a few cases with me, so they may not like me, they may do like me, but they use my stuff. That I confirmed several times.
I guess I should start out with this. National Geographic did a big special with you about that. And I watched a couple of clips through your website. My thing is when you were with that woman from National Geographic and she was kind of surprised of all the stuff going on. And I know you kind of explained a little bit about what goes on the streets earlier on. Have you saw like really young girls out there? That's the thing that kind of makes me a little scary and about to see on the street that are like, you know, cooking or being prostitutes in general.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know.
Lots. Not the majority, but over like, my years, yeah.
How old are you talking about? Like, are we talking about like 15, 14, stuff like that, or even younger? That's a little sick, but.
I've only seen younger once in my life. Oh, and God. Because on Figueroa, it's so glamorous and so bragged about, that could have been a young girl who had maybe a 35-year-old mother or a 26-year-old sister who's doing it and think that she wants to be grown. But I know of, this was actually a brothel run by a woman. She kept foster kids, and the foster kids were girls. And I think one or two was doing it. And then as I started to deal with the one or two and I went back to the house, I realized that it wasn't one or two doing it. It's the whole house, because I know a retired hooker when I see one. And when that woman came outside on that porch and started smiling and licking her lips at me, I said, oh, I see what this is. See, I know what I'm looking at. I know what I'm looking at. I said, all five of these girls dressed like that, they're going to work. I said, oh, and I see why you're looking at me, and I know what you want to ask me. You know, but someone I was dealing with in different type of business was two doors down. And I'm just going to put it out there. At that time, that wouldn't have bothered me. I would have just engulfed that. But what I was doing was going to bring in more money. And my mind is already set on taking care of A, B, and C. I have to get in a different mindset to take care of X, Y, and Z. So I'm over here for something a little heavier. So I'm not going to go into full-blown Mac mode and walk over to you and this and that. But I can tell, I said, she knows what I am. And as she's looking at me and looking at them, looking at me and smiling, looking at them, I said, I know what she's doing. You know, so that one had young girls. And yeah, you see some young ones out there. But young to me, when I say young girls, I'm talking like 21, 22. But over the years, we're talking almost three decades. Yeah, I've seen very young ones. That night at National Geographic, I saw a girl that looked maybe about 12.
Wow. That's a little scary, yeah.
And I was explaining to her, I said, you see these girls under the lights? And she said, yeah, why are they huddled up like that? I said, they all have the same pimp. She said, how can you tell? I said, look at their shoes. I said, they're all wearing the same exact clear heels with the same exact glitter. I said, that wasn't by accident. They don't go shopping together. I said, they're clustered up because all of their money is going to one space. They're under the light so that they can be seen. They don't care if the police sees them. Because if you take one girl, there's still money being made. That's his billboard. I said, you see that girl across the street? Looks about 12. I said, why is she in dark? I said, you see the girls walking back and forth? Why is she standing still? I said, she's being forced. She's being trafficked. I said, if you make a left down that street, you're going to see a guy in a beat up car, because you don't bring your real cars out there. He's going to be crouched down and he has an eyes view of her. And he's staring right at her. I said, that's why she's standing still. That's why she's in the dark. I said, so if you're going to rescue someone, you go rescue her. He's not going to confront you. He's going to drive away. You go rescue her. Those three over there, you try to rescue them, they'll shoot you, stab you, or run off, because this is what they want to do. This is a stage and they are actresses. This they're performing. That girl over there needs to be snatched up and taken to somewhere safe. I said, but those girls, no, they'll file a lawsuit against you, try to grab them. This is what they want to do. They're having a good time. They saw our cameras and someone started twerking. And she's like, are they twerking for? I said, yes. I told you this is a stage. These women are electrified out there, but not her over there. And I would drive on the street, I'd be like, and I mean, it's a shame that I can identify that quick. I'd be like, those are strippers who are just going to be out here a couple of days. Those are actual track walkers. There's a drug addict. She's being trafficked. She's being trafficked. She's a member of a stable. She doesn't have a pimp. She doesn't have a pimp. She does. It's just after 30 years, you know what you're looking at. You know, she doesn't come out here often. She's out here every night. She, you know, you just, I can tell.
But Mickey, why aren't the police? You know, they're supposed to be trained for this stuff. If they see a girl that's, you know, hell with the prostitutes, like you said, that's what they want to do. And that's how they're making their money. God bless them. You know, it's America. You can make your money as long as it's, I think it should be legal personally, because you see all these politicians getting off to all this stuff. So why not? You know, if they're supposed to be making the laws, you know, but anyways, that's a different story for a different day. But why aren't these cops seeing what you're seeing when they see these young girls, or whether they're 12 or 20 something, being trafficked, and they just, I guess they don't do anything, or is, you know.
Well, a lot of them, for many reasons, a lot of them don't have the experience I do. They work 8-hour shifts. They work 24-hour shift for 30 years. I'm there. I'm always there. I don't go home. I am at home. This is my home. I don't leave. You know, a zookeeper knows a little, a hunter knows a little bit about the jungle, but not as much as a lion, because when he goes home to his family, this is my home. I don't ever leave this place. That's part of it. Another part of it is you're looking at the process of legalization. And there's four steps. First, because legalization comes with legislation. Only people that can make things legal are people who write laws. So you have to decriminalize, then you legalize, then you organize, and then finally you unionize. So those are the four steps. But what they're going to do is, because they're not well trained in this area, they're going to follow the model that they did for marijuana. They're going to follow the model that they did during prohibition. What they're going to run into problems with is midway through the organization part, because they don't know really what they're doing. Those are products. You're dealing with a service. That's a human being. So you can only do decriminalization from the legislative part. You can only do legalization from the legislative part. Halfway through the organization, that's where you'll have a problem. And that's when I step back in to offer my services for a fee. And then unionization comes later. And that's where the protection comes. And that's where the organization comes. And that will be the model for legalizing prostitution or sex work throughout the country. And when you think of sex work, don't just think of women. Every movie I made had a man in it. So don't just think of women. I had men I had to send to. Oh, she's 72 years old. Her husband died. He was a plastic surgeon. So she has the body of a 50-year-old. She saw a movie you were in, you know, because I had these guys I used to call my tripods, the guys that could open their legs and lean forward and not hit the ground. So I would say, you know, batter number two, you're up. Man, come on, man. How old is she, man? 72? No, she's 75. But she has $20 million and she's here for the weekend. Man, do I have to? What's good for the goose is good for the gander. Let's go. Hey, I don't have another movie I'm shooting for 6 weeks. So you want to make this or not? It can turn into a long, because women customers who are looking for male prostitutes or gigolos, they like long-term type of things. So don't think it was just, I expanded. You know, I expanded. Women from other countries, I had everything. All of them, because porn opened that door up. But no, there you won't see the cops coming down on it, because they know what's up for two reasons. Like I said, number one, they don't have the experience and they don't really know. You can't learn this from the outside looking in. But and number two, the ones who kind of know, the word has come down that ease up. Let's get these killers. Let's get the drug dealers. The traffickers, you're going to have to stop, because there will be no legalization with traffickers. And traffickers usually lead to some type of murderous situation. And that's not what they're getting into that for. That's not free choice. I tell people, human trafficking is not pimping. It's just kidnapping and extortion.
Right.
You can do that with a guy walking down the street like Debo and Friday. What you got on my trip? That's all that is kidnapping and extortion. That's not... No, a trafficker.
Yeah, I think that's what more people should be concerned about, is the trafficking. I mean, I just think that this other stuff is just, like we said, what people want to do. You know, it's America. You can do whatever you want to make money, as long as it should be legal. Again, and we have all these politicians, to reiterate the same point, that do this stuff. They're always cheating on their wives, and whether it's with prostitutes or whatever it could be. You know, I mean, it's just a simple thing. What do you hope that the listeners learn from this interview and from the book in general?
You can use these techniques anywhere. Mm-hmm. You'd be surprised. Most of the compliments I get about my book are people who use my techniques on their job. On their jobs. Because they identify, oh, that must be the bottom woman. Oh, that's the man. Oh, here's the hustler. They identify the chess pieces. Most of the people I help are usually guys who want help in trying to approach women and become playboys, or, you know, guy with the five chicks that everybody loves them. Or it'd be people on their job who navigate through the top. How you wonder how, you know, Bob, he's late every day. Bob doesn't do a good job. Bob just got a promotion. How? Bob has been playing chess while you're playing checkers. It's certain things, Bob, no, you don't, it doesn't go to the person who has that's what I like about chess. It doesn't, the person who collects the most pieces is not usually the winner. Poker, I play poker avidly. You don't have to have the best hand to win. It's a mind game. I'm watching you. I'm not watching the cards. I don't even have to look at them. I can look at you, you know, and your tails and things like that. So I want them, because it's basically an ink block. You will get out of it what's already in your mind that you want to see in it, but the techniques are proven. But that's what and also it can clear up a lot of misconceptions. You know, a lot of misconceptions, because everyone bases the Hollywood narrative off the last Hollywood narrative. So we get this monolith, you know, oh, he's walking like a pimp. Oh, that's a pimp mobile. That's how pimps really. That, no, Bobby Knight is a coach. He's liable to choke his players. Phil Jackson is a coach. He's liable to read some scriptures out of Buddhist manual and Confucius to his players. They both have championships, but you can't say, you know, Bobby Knight, he acts more like a coach. No, he acts more like what your preconceived notion of how a coach should act. Whatchamacallit, Phil Jackson. He is equally a coach, just as much a winner. He's not going to raise his voice above a whisper. Bobby Knight talks as if he's flying a helicopter and he's trying to speak over this loudspeaker. But they're both winners. They're both coaches. But I can't tell you, oh, how's a basketball coach look? Well, stereotypically, he wears a sweatsuit. He has a whistle. He has some kind of cap with the team insignia, and he talks loud. That's what a coach is in my mind. Then I meet Phil Jackson. And I say, should I pass the ball to Michael Jordan? How do you feel about the ball? Let's discuss. See, he's a coach too, but that's what he's going to respond with. So you have to get the stereotypes out of your mind, and that's what I like to do, because you can get down to the nitty-gritty of what it is instead of who it is.
Well, it's the stereotypes of what you did. It's the stereotypes about pornography. It's the stereotypes of why people deal drugs. A lot of these people that deal drugs, they're dealing it because they need money, because they can't survive. They don't, you know, they can't get a job that pays more than $8, $9, $10 an hour. You know, if you live out in California, you need some pretty good money to buy a pretty decent sized house. Doesn't matter where the hell you are. But we'll end with this, because I do want to get into the next part of the interview on, I believe we said the 29th, but I can check whatever. But I think people should definitely check out the book. And we're going to talk about the other books in the next interview. Again, this was Mickey Royal, mickeyroyal.com. Definitely check him out. I'm really looking forward to the next interview. And Mickey, thanks so much for coming on. Greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, and they can find me on Amazon.
Right. Well, yeah, you can definitely check out his books. Again, Amazon. I know, I think they're on mickeyroyal.com too. I thought that's where I saw
them. That just links you to Amazon.
Oh, okay. Well, regardless, definitely check out the books. Like I said, we're going to go into the other books in the next podcast. I'm really looking forward to it. So, Mickey, thanks again.
Thank you. The pleasure is mine, and anytime.